fourth and last case for today, William Vincent et al. Versus Jack Boyd et al., 97-3174. And I have, as my timing and the speaker's Tony Hazen for 20 minutes, representing William Vincent et al., Bruce Meredith for 20 minutes, representing the intervening plaintiffs, Terrence Craney et al., Peter Anderson, Assistant Attorney General, representing Jack Boyd et al., 45 minutes, and then 2.5 minutes each for Attorneys Hazy and Meredith in rebuttal. Right? Okay, agreeing on that, we'll start with you, Attorney Hazy.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is David Hazy of the law firm of Cook & Frankie, and with my partner Heidi Vogt, I am here representing the plaintiffs in this matter, the Vincent plaintiffs, and we are the plaintiffs and the co-appellants in this matter. This case, of course, is about public schools, and the public schools are a unique American institution. They really have been the engine of democracy, driving progress, providing stability for society, and they have been an important institution. And as such, they have been nurtured in particular by the states and protected by state constitutions. Article 10, of course, is the education article of the Wisconsin Constitution. And it was created as the rich constitutional history elaborates, to serve the needs of a new state, challenge to assimilate waves of immigrants, and build a strong community and economy. The founders had one principle clearly in mind, and that was that the state was to ensure education for all, not just the privileged. Article 10, Section 3, the uniformity provision, which is the provision that principally at issue in this case, says that the legislature shall create district schools which shall be nearly as uniform as practicable. As many decisions throughout the country by many courts interpreting their education articles, many of which have been cited in the briefs in this case, have held, at least in substance, the standard of uniformity, and uniformity is a theme that you find in education articles throughout the United States. The standard of uniformity is equal access to resources in sum and substance. Today I want to hit on four things. What is the problem? Why do we have the problem? How did the problem arise? And where do our clients seek to go? The problem is, very simply, the system lacks uniformity. As a result, students are denied their fundamental right to equal educational opportunities. That is a fundamental right that this court has on many occasions ratified and secured.
Mr. Hazy, just for a quick background, how many students, public school students, are affected by our system of public school finance? And how many of them do you contend are denied equal access to resources? If you can answer that.
I'm not sure I can answer that in precise terms, Your Honor. I think, if memory serves me right, that the number of public school students in the state is somewhere in the 800,000 range. The number of those students that are denied equal educational opportunities because their districts lack equal access to resources is a number that I can't precisely give you. I can say, though, that most, maybe the word is better word is many, districts would be able to improve their financial situation if the state finance system were reformed to provide equal access to resources.
Yep.
Now, this is a matter of degree, of course. In some districts, it would be much more the case than in others.
Now, Counsel, I recall in the opposing counsel brief that they went through and they said that statistically about 90, in the 90%, that there is similar uniform educational opportunities. So what we're talking about, this number that Justice Babich asked about, would that be correct? That is it greater than 10% that we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, it is greater than 10%, and let me speak...
But if we're only talking 10%, we're talking 80,000 students.
If you're talking 10%, you're talking 80,000 students. That's the math. That's correct. But let me speak to Justice Wilcox's point, because I think this is the key to the problem with the state's case. The state argues and would have the court believe that 92.5% of the districts, with 96% of the students, are fully equalized, so boy, there's no problem. The problem with that is that the state just focuses on equalization aid. And perhaps the court could refer to the handout which we provided, and I apologize for one more piece of paper. But the handout we have provided illustrates the whole school finance system. And you'll see there that equalized payments is 47% in 1996-97 of local and state funding. That's what the state focuses on, and that's what the state relies on when it says that we're only concerned about 7.5% of the students. What the state is doing, and here I refer you to page 7 of our reply brief, what the state is doing is ignoring about 24, almost 25% of the state contribution to the finance system. What the state is ignoring is the other items that are shown on the handout, the levy tax credit, the integration aid, the first tier hold harmless, the categorical aid. Those elements, which make up about 24% of the state contribution, the state ignores in its analysis entirely. And by ignoring that, what they do is assume the problem away.
Well, now the plaintiff. I'm not quite sure I understand the problem. And I'm looking at page 12 of your brief. The goal is to equalize property poor and property rich districts so that every district that exerts the same tax expert effort, can spend at the same level. Now, just let's move away for the moment from the funding system we have now. Suppose it was all state financed, okay, and the state gave each school district the exact same amount of money. Would that be uniform according to your definition? Would it pass constitutional muster?
It would, except to the extent that it did not consider legitimate special needs, but that's more the issue that Mr. Meredith...
No, that's my point of my question.
Yeah.
Seems to me that the two plaintiffs here don't have the exact same position, and that the question I asked goes to Mr. Meredith's party. So I want you to tell me what your position is in terms of what constitutes uniformity and equalization. What kind of funding, local and state funding, would you provide that would make it correct under your interpretation?
Well, I think Your Honor is pointed to at least one place in our briefs where we have tried to explain that. If we are going to have a property tax-based system, or a system that utilizes a substantial local property tax, it is necessary to in some way adjust for the disparate tax bases. And in order to do that, all of the state money which comes into the system needs to be equalized. And very simply, that's what we think would provide equal access to resources. That, conversely, that's what we think denies it at this point in time, because not all of that funding is equalized.
Where do you get when you equalize it? What's the bottom line? That every district deserves the same tax effort? Does that mean on the assessment value is the same weight?
That means that these analyses we've used equalized values, But what that means is that at any given level of spending, districts that spend at that level, pick a number, say $8,000 a student, those districts would exert the same amount of tax effort. Now, if a district chose to spend $9,000, then it would exert a greater tax effort, but it would be the same tax effort as another district that chose to spend at that level.
No, a district council can do that now, can't they? They can spend different levels. I mean, under local control, as I understand it, and I don't quite understand your saying, well, we've got equalized things, and I think that having served in the legislature many years ago, this is an ongoing problem, and I appreciate it, but what do you mean exactly that the districts now can equalize if they so choose through referendum? Is that correct or not? In other words, as far as spending.
The districts cannot equalize it, Your Honor, through referendum. What they can do through referendum is add to their spending and get out at least partially from the revenue caps. But in terms of the existing system, unless it is equalized at the state level, property-rich districts are going to be able to raise any amount of money with less tax effort than a property-poor district.
And that's been an ongoing battle in the legislature for many years, as far as the difference between the poor school districts and the ones that are more wealthy as far as land values. I mean, that's something that's been going on for many, many years. And your suggestion is to do what? I mean, you talked about equalizing, but the reason I'm asking this is that this case comes to us in this posture. We have a trial judge that said that there was not sufficient evidence for us to have a system that does not provide equal access. We have the Court of Appeals in a unanimous decision said there wasn't sufficient factual basis. And what I'm asking is, what facts do you have that this will cure the problem that you're talking about?
Well, our problem, the problem that we are focusing on is the problem that results when you have disparate tax bases, yes, as I've said. And what has happened is that, and Your Honor is quite right, this has been going on for quite some time. In fact, it's been going on since the Buzet case knocked out a equalized system, and the legislature has done nothing to repair the damage that was done. Now, the evidence which the Court of Appeals and the trial court glossed over, which the plaintiffs have presented, and this is in particular found in the affidavits of Dr. Stotts, the evidence shows a couple of things. First of all, on one level, on a statistical analysis, looking at all the districts across the whole state, the property-rich districts can spend more and do spend more and tax at lower rates than the property-poor districts. And this is true before and after 1995 Act 27, when additional monies were put into the system.
Mr. Harvey, are you acquainted with the spending that various districts, at least the high and the low, for me to ask a question about that?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, let me try. As I understand the problem, that maybe I'm wrong, but what you're saying is that a poor district, a property poor district, if they were to spend the same amount per student as a property rich district that really cares about education, and therefore spends a lot for its students, would have to tax themselves far more than the richest district. Taxes, in other words, it's impossible for them. You can only squeeze so much blood out of that property for districts. So what can you give us a comparison, say, between a very poor property district and a very rich property district, and how much that poor property district would have to tax themselves in order to spend as much as that property-rich district? I notice that you've got at least two graphs in your brief, but neither one of those, I think, addressed my...
Your specific question, no. Well, Your Honor, I think if you would take the school district of Gibraltar, which is the richest in the state, property-wise, and the school district of Algoma, which is right nearby, and take those two districts, and I may have the specific numbers not quite in mind, but...
They're in your brief,
isn't that
right?
They are in. Yeah. There's about a $7 difference in taxing.
So Algoma would have to tax themselves $7 more than the citizens of Gibraltar in order to
spend about $2,000 less.
To spend $2,000 less?
Yes. That's a dramatic example of the problem.
How would you address that?
If this court were to declare the constitutional standard of uniformity as it affects the finance system to be equal access to resources, the legislature would then have to go back and say, how do we adjust for these tremendously disparate tax bases? And frankly, Your Honor, it could be done through the equalization formula by putting all of the state funding through the equalization formula. Now, the legislature, this is a legislative decision, and the legislature might have find other devices or several devices to work to do it with, but that is the way that you would adjust for these inequities.
You wouldn't have categorical aids?
Categorical aids, as they are now paid, are flat aids, and therefore they go to all districts regardless of wealth. We would say that categorical aids should be equalized as well as other aids. And there are several ways to do that. There could be weighting for categorical factors in the formula. That's something that's done in many states throughout the country, where weighting is used to take into account the categories the legislature thinks ought to get extra funding.
Have you figured out what the fiscal note is on your plan?
The fiscal note on our plan could be neutral. You don't have to spend any more money. It would be redistributed. It would be distributed in a very different way than it is now. But there would not have to be any additional funds put into the system. Again, a legislative decision.
Well, just hypothetically, suppose you have a school district in rural Wisconsin, Ashton, one of your plans, wants to spend as much money as the Nicolay School District. What is to prevent them from doing that and then forcing up formula somewhere?
Well, if the Cashton District wanted to spend as much as the Nicolay District, there would be a very substantial local tax to pay. And there would also be a higher local tax to pay in the Nicolay District, and the market forces might adjust the Nicolay.
How do you force up the tax rate in Nicolay?
Oh, I don't think it would be forced up. I think if we equalize... Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Paxton says we want to spend... We're spending here. We want to spend here. And when we spend up here, Nicolay's tax effort is still down here. I mean, we don't have to have a tax effort higher than Nicolay under your plan, do we?
No, you'd have to have a tax effort equivalent to Nicolay.
I beg your pardon?
Under our plan, Cashton would have a tax effort equivalent to Nicolay.
Okay, but there are property-rich districts with a low tax effort that spend a lot of money. And what is to prevent every district in the state of saying, we want to be just like Nicolay?
Well, there would be nothing to prevent them from saying that. The question would be, in a fully equalized system, whether they would be willing to pay the substantial additional local tax that would be required.
But I thought you said the tax effort had to be identical.
To spend the same, the tax effort would have to be identical. So if a district, if Cashton wants to spend the same as Nicolay, they would have the same tax effort.
And that would be their choice.
And that would
be
their
Cashton's choice to go to the voters and make that referendum possible and have them vote on it.
That's right. But... And I see my red light is on, but one last point is that I'm talking about this in a fully equalized system where Nicolay's tax rate would be higher. Because Nicolay is making less effort now than it would in a fully equalized system.
But then I asked you before, how are you going to force up Nicolay's tax effort?
If they continue to spend at the level they are now spending in an equalized system, their tax effort would have to be higher.
So is this a state property tax?
No, this would not be a state property tax. It would be the effect of withdrawing a considerable amount of state aid, which they get now, which would go out through the equalization formula to other districts, requiring Nicolay to raise its local levy if it wanted to maintain its level of spending.
Well, I think you could probably withdraw all the aid from Gibraltar and not materially affect their taxing effort. Am I wrong?
In that one case, you may be right because of the substantial value there.
But you want, according to the quote on page 12, you want all the taxing efforts in the state to be the same. We all want to be, just like we all want to be like Michael, we all want to be like Gibraltar.
Well, I think we want the system to be such that, yes, all districts that are spending at a given level would tax at a given level, and that can be accomplished by fully equalizing the system.
Well, you have to, sounds like, the legislature would have to say everybody has to tax at, and pick a 2% of the assessed value for schools, whatever, 5%, 10%. Then you'd have to redistribute this money so that everybody would have a school child getting $10,000. I mean, isn't that your goal, that there be equal tax levy, and that each district would have available the same amount per student?
No.
I mean, then that's that gives you total equality. Equality on tax rate and equality on expenditure. I mean, we've been talking about equality, but I don't know what the equality is.
Well,
I mean, do you want equality in tax rate and equality in ultimate spending per student?
We want every district to have the same opportunity as any other district to raise money. And that does not mean that each district has to spend the same. It just means that when a district makes a spending decision, that spending decision is backed up by a tax rate that's no more or no less than another district that makes a spending decision at the same level.
The tax rate in Milwaukee should be the same as the tax rate for school purposes as Madison.
No, if Milwaukee chooses to spend more or less than Madison, its tax rate would be more or less than Madison's. If they were spending at the same level, yes, their tax rate should be the same.
Would you have a statewide assessor, a statewide assessment system?
Well, I think we do, Your Honor, with the equalized system. I mean, and then that's what's used in school finance. The Department of Revenue equalizes.
Well, I guess what I'm asking, each community has their own assessor, village or the town or the city. Would you have a statewide assessor and a statewide system of assessment that would provide this equalization?
I don't think that would be... I think we already have that, Your Honor, through the Department of Revenue, which equalizes tax rates for schools and municipalities.
Well, they tell us that in our tax bill, but there's real variations. Is there not from area to area?
There are real variations, but the state aids are paid on the equalized basis, that is, the statewide basis.
Thank you, Mr. Hasey. Mr. Meredith? We're having the same problem.
May it please the court. My name is Bruce Meredith. I'm general counsel of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, with my colleague Chris Gallinet, are representing the interveners in this action. We are here today because approximately 10 years ago, a plurality of this court in Cooker v. Grover effectively removed Article 10, Section 3 from the Wisconsin Constitution. On behalf of all Wisconsin children, interveners ask that this court restore Article 10, Section 3, and give it its intended meaning. As noted by both the trial and appellate courts, Cooker has proved unworkable in providing litigants, lower courts, or the legislature any meaningful guide in determining whether Wisconsin schools are meeting their required constitutional mandate. Moreover, as noted by Justice Dykeman in his concurring opinion, the current system has permitted serious educational obstacles to block our Constitution's goal of giving all children a chance to succeed. But under Cooker, as noted by Judge Dykeman, he is powerless to act. Because we believe that the paramount issue before this court is achieving a proper interpretation of Article 10, Section 3, I will first consider that issue before discussing why the current system fails any reasonable construction of Article 10, and then suggesting possible dispositions of this matter. Article 10, Section 3 could not be more clear in its general command. Wisconsin schools are to be as nearly uniform as practical. Unfortunately, a plurality of this court in Cooper found that what this language really says is that schools shall be as nearly uniform as any given legislature deems appropriate. This conclusion must be reversed, first and foremost because of the violence it does to both the literal language and constitutional history of Article 10, also because of the damage it inflicts on the most basic principles of constitutional law. Interveners assert that the language and constitutional history of Article 10 give the court a clear direction, if not a precise final destination. Wisconsin children, regardless of where they live or their social circumstance, are entitled to have an equal opportunity to become an educated person, subject, of course, to the real-world limitations recognized even in the Cooper dissent that prevent society from ever achieving complete equality. The plurality in Cooper did not directly attack this concept. Indeed, it endorsed Bussey's conclusion that equal educational opportunity is a fundamental right. It further discussed at length the importance of education. However, what it proclaimed as fundamental in one breath it dismissed as inconsequential in the next. Because, according to Cooper, all that is guaranteed Wisconsin children is a schoolhouse and certain basic courses. The rest is for the legislature to give or take as it pleases. In fact, the state has gone so far as to argue as long as schools provide more training than they did in 1848, the system is constitutional. Clearly, this is no standard at all. Without such a meaningful standard, there is no constitutional floor, either in terms of equity or adequacy. Although the state spends considerable time praising the current system, under its analysis, most of its brief was a mere diversion, because Wisconsin could become among the very worst states in terms of equity or adequacy, and its conclusion that the system is constitutional would remain the same. This leaves the question of what it means to become an educated person. In striking down educational financing systems across the country, virtually all courts that have considered this issue had arrived at a common definition. In one form or another, courts have adopted a definition similar to that adopted by the three dissenting judges, Justices and Cooper, wherein they define equal educational opportunity as training which equips children for their roles as citizens, participants in the political system, and competitors in both the labor market and the marketplace of ideas. Some courts...
I'm just going to interrupt you, Mr. Meredith.
Sure.
There have been about maybe 20 years, a little more, of school cases, school financing cases across the country, including the United States Supreme Court. And as I understand these cases, they started out with the courts looking at the state constitution, talking about equity in terms of tax, equity in terms of from the taxpayer being fair, of one district having a higher tax rate than another to provide even less funds, so that it was an equity from a tax basis. But that the more recent cases now look at, in terms of uniformity under the state constitutions, they look at the doctrine of adequacy of education. And I've been listening to you very carefully, and you have been using both terms, equity.
Yes.
And I assume in equity you're talking about tax burden, or maybe not, and then adequacy, and that's what you were starting in, talks about what kind of education the children are getting.
Yes.
So
is that right, or
am I wrong?
No, you're exactly correct.
Right.
I actually think the dissent in Cooper was simply a bit ahead of its time.
I reread Cooper, and it did go to the adequacy as I read it.
And it's been cited by many, at least two courts, and referred to by others, saying that what the standard this court needs to grapple with is a fusion of both equity and adequacy. Because in the end, you're trying to make children competitive. That is the virtue of these systems. You want to give all children a chance. And to do that, one of the first things you do in competition is to look what your competitors have. So to some extent, you do look at the equality and the fiscal arguments, but you also have to look at our children learning sufficient core knowledge in order to allow them to compete in today's world. And I don't think these concepts are in any way at odds. There's been several law review articles that suggest they're really just a fusion and just a new way of looking at an old problem.
How do we measure that if that's the definition of uniformity? By educational outcomes or by comparison of physical plants or by comparison of curriculum? What do you suggest?
Well, let me respond to that, but I think the first thing the court has to do before you can really give an intelligent response to your question is to establish a constitutional standard. Because under the Cooper standard, no one knows what to look at, and
okay,
that's been the problem. Now, addressing your question, I think the legislature could address equality in a number of ways, but I think essentially it has to have three characteristics. One, it must distribute sufficient resources so as to give all districts the funds necessary to allow students to become educated persons, regardless of the district's property wealth or its educational needs. Now, this can be done through an input focus. Some courts have looked at that. It could be done through more of an output focus. And indeed, one of our arguments in the brief that I hope I have time to address is Wisconsin appears to be moving in that direction, and the legislature is establishing outcome standards. That is another possible outcome.
That's another way of viewing equity. I not commending the court one way or the other, I think ultimately the legislature is the primary body that should choose how to implement this court's general dictates on equity. But you can look at it either way, but I think one of the key points is that even under the current system, I don't know how children are going to pass the state's outcome standards that they recently enacted. And that's a point I'd like to discuss a little later.
As I look at this case, as I looked at it 10 years ago, the real issue is whether or not the children in this state are getting what the Constitution guarantees them. Because the majority, everybody agreed in Cooper that the Constitution gave the children of this state a fundamental right of an equal opportunity for education.
Yes.
So I see the issue in this case as whether or not Wisconsin's system of finance provides an equal opportunity for education of the children as mandated by the state constitution.
Yes.
Now that gets me back to the question that I asked Mr. Hosley. You obviously believe that it does not. But any system is going to discriminate against some, because we can never have complete uniformity. Question, I think it's a very simple question. How many children does this system discriminate against? How many children are denied that fundamental right in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, Justice Babich, under your standard enunciated in the dissent at Cooper, I would think a very substantial portion, because the Wisconsin formula has one substantial failing in terms of its equity, and that it does not take into account student needs. I believe there are problems with what's called horizontal equity, which Mr. Hosse was talking about, but Wisconsin's real problem is it does nothing, virtually nothing, to address the fact that some children come to school much better prepared to learn than others. And I don't think the state has ever really quarreled with our assertion that this is a major problem. It simply cites Cooper and says it doesn't matter. And I don't know what number of kids become constitutionally insignificant, but I feel certain that the current system affects a substantial number of them and denies them the right to be effective competitors.
Didn't the state concede around 35,000?
Well, but that's just looking at the horizontal equity. It did not even address the questions of need-based, because Wisconsin basically does nothing in that regard. And so if you throw in the fact that it's much more difficult to educate a child in the city of Milwaukee, the typical student, than its suburbs just to the north, the figure would rise dramatically.
Yeah, one last question. Since Cooper, both you and Mr. Hosse made the claim that the system has become more disequalized. What is different about the financing system today that did not exist at the time of Cooper?
Two things. First of all, there's been a dramatic reduction in the amount of categorical aids. And categorical aids are basically aids that go to limited English-speaking students and disabled students. There's been a dramatic decline in those. In addition, there has been no real attempt to deal with low-income children. That, I think, is one factor. The other, and perhaps even more significant factor, is revenue controls. And one of the points we try making in our brief is that there is an interactive feature between the drop in categorical aids and the imposition of revenue controls, because categorical aids, perhaps despite legislative oversight, were taken outside of the caps. So every time you reduce categorical aids because of high-needs children, the money that's supposed to go to the kids in general aids instead goes to the taxpayers. And I think the most dramatic example of this is the Wausau School District. I think if the court reads the affidavits of the three Wausau administrators, it's our appendix 271 to 278, those three affidavits in and of themselves would indict the system so seriously that summary judgment would have to be reversed.
Let's go through those three affidavits.
Yeah.
Sorry you mentioned Wausau.
She said to me.
The affidavit, I think in February of 1997, of Linnell Anderson, indicated that at that time, 34% of the kindergarten population was
LES, limited English speaking.
In particular, Hmong, which is more difficult because they don't have a written language.
Well, indeed. That affidavit, as I recall it, says that since the language of the Hmong culture wasn't reduced to writing until the 1950s, and the affidavit took us through an example of something that is, for most parents, mundane. You get a note back from the school saying your kid needs eyeglasses, take the kid to be tested. The affidavit went on to recount that in a culture like Hmong, and with student population of 34% in kindergarten and anticipated rising the percentage, this is what this particular teacher was encountering. First of all, the notice has to be translated, which into Hmong, which is resource intensive. But because, according to the affidavit, about 50% of the parents can't read, then they have to hire someone on the phone that can interpret the language and call the parents. And because the culture is such that there is a lack of knowledge and appreciation in some areas for education, that they meet a response that the parents are afraid to have this kind of exam for their child because they don't understand it, or they don't think their child needs to get glasses because they don't think their children need to read. Children need to read. 34% of the population, as I understand it, in the kindergarten class and rising. How? And I understand another affidavit says that there are so many resources taken from mainstream children to fund these special needs children. How can you show by way of proof, because that is an argument that's made against you, both in the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, make reference to, okay, you tell us these are problems, and I can recite these facts, and boy, they sound horrible. But where's your proof?
Well,
that the funding in that municipality or that district relates, results in an unequal opportunity for education. Where's your proof?
In two areas. First, I think one of the scariest concepts in Wausau, and applies to this, a lot of other districts just like Wausau presents it more dramatically, is in the affidavit of the superintendent. It says what's happening now is they cut their main programming, is that the easier to educate kids are leaving for private schools. But there's a second thing that goes right to your point. Unfortunately, when this record was created, we did not have the knowledge and concepts exam. We cited some in our brief. You can go to the DPI website, look at the most recent ones. And what's happened is Wausau older children who were at the top on these tests are now in the middle. And the fourth graders who were in the middle are now in the bottom.
And you're not, are you talking about LES children?
The whole Wisconsin, all of Wausau's children. Because the amount of resources that had to be devoted to this issue took away from what the regular education students have. And one of the advantages, if the court allows this case to go forward under a reasonable standard and we have a trial, we now have access to data that can be concrete, that we can establish inferences that we had much more difficult time doing it before these exams were placed. So I think one advantage of giving a trial is we will be able to establish the serious impact high-needs kids have on the overall regular education program.
Counsel, you have in your appendix, page 324, some test results. For instance, test results for fourth graders LES children. For reading, 25% are proficient as opposed to those who speak English naturally, 70% proficient. Language, 9% versus 41%. Mathematics, the LES children proficiency is 20%. The general population is 52%.
Right.
How do these statistics relate to what you're advancing?
I think they relate in two ways. just on a general basis, they show that certain children who come from low income and limited English speaking and who are disabled, we list all three, all perform substantially less well on these tests. But I think they even more dramatically relate, because we have to put this into context, that starting in 2002, these children are going to have to pass basic competency exams in order to be promoted, in order to graduate. Now, under the current system of revenue controls, how are these districts going to fund the remedial programs to give these kids a chance to pass these tests? Now, I'd like to respond to one argument that I believe Justice Wilcox was making, that on revenue controls. The issue is, well, all they have to do is pass a referendum. And I guess I have three responses to that. The most important response is that I think there is a core constitutional right to equal educational opportunity that can't be taken away by state edict, it can't be taken away by local school board action, and it certainly can't be taken away by a vote of the general populace. If there is a core constitutional right and it's fundamental, it transcends the moment-to-moment politics. But secondly, you have to understand that people pass referenda in the context of the current financing system. And therefore, those districts that are prejudiced by the system, those voters have to vote in that system. And finally, for reasons indicated in our brief, courts have historically held that referendums almost always work to the disadvantage of minority interests. And those are the interests we are primarily concerned about in our case.
Can I ask two questions? On the basis of what you said, Mr. Meredith, is your position the same on categorical aids as the speaker who spoke before?
Well, I don't think we really have a substantially different position. I don't think that the plaintiffs suggest that high-needs kids should not receive targeted amounts. They want it to go through the equalization formula. Frankly, we don't care how the legislature gives it to the high-needs kids. We want it to get to them. We think the SAGE program is proving remarkably effective, and that should be something that the legislature might want to continue. But you need money too there. I guess we're just not as choosy as the plaintiffs on how it gets there. I notice my stop. I would like to make one at least final conclusion.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Seems to me that one of the problems is to be easy to say, hard to say, nor where to say that you need an equal opportunity for education. I mean, that's apple pie. I don't talk about motherhood, but apple pie. But how do you define that? And now, so I'm looking at, I know what Cooper said in a sentence. In Justice Babbage's dissent, an equal opportunity for a proper education necessarily kind of thinks the playing field will be leveled so each child has an equal chance. But then in your brief, and I'm looking at pages 28 and following, some courts have attempted to set forth some general statements about what constitutes a thorough or an efficient or equal education. And I think we had started questioning you when you were on your way to make reference to that. Because the complaint in the circuit court and in the court of appeals is that we, this court, has never set forth what we mean by equal opportunity, equal educational opportunity. So the legislature doesn't have a constitutional standard to fit into.
Let me address your, I think this is at the core of this issue, so let me address it in two ways. First, I think that there's one concern that this doesn't admit itself to a bright line test. But there's all sorts of provisions in the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. Due process is fluid. You take apportionment cases. There's a number of cases where you cannot apply a bright line test, but still the court enters the area. Now, as to your second question, is how does the court enter this murky area? But basically, courts have done it sort of two ways. One has, we're going to define this general thing and see what the legislature has to say about it. And then we'll look at what the legislature has done. The other, which is in the Rose case, in the Kentucky, lesser extent in the Campbell case in Wyoming, the court sets more precise parameters for the legislature. Again, I think that is your choice We are not arguing for one or the other. It's whatever you think will be most likely to produce a legislative system that produces uniformity.
How would you define it generally in the first part? You see, there are two ways, kind of generally, and define it as Rose does. What would your general definition be, the one we've already used?
Well, I actually think the dissent in Cooper, if I had to pick, had it right, because ultimately I think the goal is to make children competitors in the labor market and competitors in the marketplace of ideas. And what that will be will change over time. Take technology. At the time of Cooper, that would have been viewed as a frill. Now you certainly can't say technology is not. So ultimately, I think the best approach is for the court to look at what it takes kids to tell the legislature, tell us what you think it takes for kids to succeed in today's world. Enunciate that standard. We'll review it. Perhaps interveners will agree, and this case will go away.
So my question is, then, what you're saying is that this court becomes, I hate to use the language in your opposing counsel's brief, is a super legislator, which has been used before, but also you're asking us, after we give this back to the legislature, and there's no argument from my part on equal education. That is a principle I think that we're all striving for, but then you're saying, well, if they don't do it right, then we'll be back up here. So what you have is a third branch of government, obviously independent, impartial, but looking over the shoulder of the legislature to decide what obviously is a real social situation, and one that we'll be asked to take a look at again, because it's just established and others have indicated it won't obviously be perfectly equal. We'll do the best we can, but then it'll come back.
My response is that's not something I want. That's something the framers of our Constitution told this court they had to do.
Yep.
When they drafted that article, if you look at the constitutional history, look at the language, this court is entrusted with setting those general
principles.
And
then at some point we would say, well, that is uniformity to the extent which is practicable under the Constitution.
Yes. Okay. And this leads me to just my closing point. What do we want? Give us a meaningful standard and allow us to go to trial. That's what we want.
You want to go to trial? I thought you wanted summary judgment.
Well, I would appreciate summary judgment. And I think there are basis, and in my rebuttal, I think on several areas there's uncontroverted facts which would allow you to strike down certain portions of the formula, even now. But I think in general, our key focus is to get a meaningful standard, because without a meaningful standard, we really don't know how to evaluate the evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Meredith. Mr. Anderson, Assistant Attorney General representing the defendant respondents, Jack Boyd et al.
I'm just going to get my water.
Pardon me? Good idea.
May it please the court, my name is Peter Anderson. I'm Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, representing the respondents. When I came to work this morning, one of my colleagues saw I had a suit on. He said, "What's up?" I told him. He said, "Well, you got all those nutty cases." And then he went on to explain that what he meant by that is that a lot of the cases I deal with really are sort of unrelated to all the other cases I deal with. So they're all sort of sui generis, at least for me. But that isn't true. And one case in particular, since I've got this case, thanks to Kathleen Falk running for county exec, and I got the case. Since I've had this case, and through today, I have always had this strong feeling that this case was a lot like one that we handled in the federal courts in the 90s involving the United States Census. That was a case where the argument was that something was supposed to be as much as something as practicable. Specifically, the genesis of the argument was, under federal constitutional principles, congressional districts have to be as equal as practicable. That's a established and understandable constitutional standard. It didn't take too long for some creative advocates to think, well, that equality of districts was only as good as the numbers that you used. And the argument then came, was presented, that the census had to be as accurate as practicable. And that, to me, is similar textually to the language we have here, where the district schools shall be as nearly uniform as practicable.
Textually, isn't it also close to the one person, one vote? You don't have to have exactly 15,000 people in each district, but it's got to be close.
And in the case of, what I was saying, in the case of congressional districts, it actually has to be exact. There's no deviation from equality can be permitted unless it can't be avoided for state congressional districts. No, it is. There is a similarity, and that's where the census argument came from. And a similar underlying problem was identified, or at least one similar to the one that Mr. Meredith has talked about, that there were groups of people who were not participating in this process, who were being excluded, and some compensatory mechanism had to be in place as a matter of constitutional doctrine to correct for it. At one point, the argument, the Second Circuit ruled that the government had to have a compelling governmental interest to not manipulate the census in the way the plaintiffs wanted there. But at the same time, there were reasons why a unanimous United States Supreme Court rejected this argument. There was, in fact, no single way to achieve census accuracy. Just as there is no single way to achieve a uniform education in this or any other state. There are many ways in which education can be funded, in which education can be performed, in which the state can assume a role, in which the local governments can assume a role. There's a whole host of ways in which that can happen. Nor is there a panacea.
But then I bring you back to the one person, one vote. Supreme Court says that is possible.
That is a big difference, Your Honor. It is possible. It is possible to take the demographics of a state, and on the computer tapes we get now, to divide them up equally among 9 or 99 or 33 districts, or 8 districts, and get exact population equality. It is feasible. It's an understandable concept, and it can be done. But that is not the same when we talk about uniform education or census accuracy or many other laudable goals. There are many ways to achieve these.
Didn't I read in your brief that we had in this state at least achieved something like 96% equality? Or?
Yeah, I would not use the word equality. I would just describe it what it is. 96% of the school children in the state live in districts whose tax rates, the relationship between tax effort and spending is the same as all the other 96%. That is, a child in Madison has the same ability to raise money as Milwaukee, as Beloit, as Whitefish Bay, as La Crosse, as Wausau. There are a handful of small districts that have high wealth, unusual amounts of high wealth, that aren't in the 96%. But as to that 96%, all the districts are treated, are effectively the same. They are treated as though, as to their first $1,000 in spending, and I'm going back to the 96, 97 numbers.
They're treated that way categorically, I mean, from the
equalization aid?
Equalizing. But what about the categorical aid?
The categorical aid is the categorical aid is a reimbursement by the state of certain categorical expenses that the districts would have.
Let me put the question differently. I will give you, for purposes of your argument, I'm assuming that at least for $3 billion out of the $4 billion that you spend on public education, like K-12, $3 billion is equalized. It doesn't have to be effective. But there is 25%, another $1 billion, actually about $950 million, that is not treated equally, that does not come with an equalized aid formula. And that's a fairly high percentage.
Well,
do you disagree with me on that?
No, I agree.
I understand it, we spend $4 billion a year on education. $3 billion comes in equalized payments, and $950 million
all right. No, that is correct. The state can be regarded as a 96-97 as having spent a little bit more than $4 billion on education if you included the school levy tax credit as part of that. There's a real argument for not including the school levy tax credit because that money doesn't actually go for education. It goes as a form of property tax relief that goes to the municipalities, not to the school districts. That is true, though, that of that $4 billion plus that the state spends, $3.1 billion was spent on equalization. That's correct. I don't know that why we would say, though, that's a low number. That's a high number compared to what happened when CUCOR was decided. It produces a tremendous level of equalization, which is what we've been talking about with the 96% of school children. The fact is there are expenditures that school districts have that we commonly believe it's appropriate to fund other than through equalization because districts may have different expenditures. They could have different expenditures for special education costs. They could have different expenditures for the SAGE program. And those are the categorical aids. But I don't know of anything that says that the number, the particular number that we've achieved is an inappropriate number other than that the plaintiffs seem to object to it. Except on the other, you know, at the same time, they say, here, you asked, Mr. Hazy, would it be constitutional if you didn't have categorical aids? Or would it be constitutional to have full equalization? That's it. And Mr. Hazy said, it would be not constitutional if the system did not consider the legitimate special needs that were unique to school districts. Well, he didn't tell us what those legitimate special needs are. But it's plain that even Mr. Hazy recognizes that categorical funding is appropriate, at least in some circumstances. I know of no constitutional principle that says it's not appropriate.
Well, but what percent of the expenditures by the local units are reimbursed by the state? Not 100% for special needs programs.
It depends on how you examine that. If you talk about how much is reimbursed by categorical funding, the number varies depending on the program. Now, I've heard, and I guess I believe it's true, that it can be as low as 25% for the LES and as high as 40% for the handicap education. But the difference, the 75% to 60%, is then subject to equalization aid. So it's not unfunded. And in fact, if you combine the equalization aid and the categorical funding, it can certainly reach 90%, if not exceed that. Well, so the total funding is quite high.
Why do we have the affidavits that we have from the superintendents and other school administrators? You make it sound like everything's fine. If you can't make enough and categorical aid, you'll get it someplace else. But boy, that seems inconsistent with the several inches that I've read and what I'm hearing.
All we have, Your Honor, as I read the superintendent's affidavits, is one, a misunderstanding of the school aid system. A number of the superintendents assert that because their district is property poor in some respect, they are worse off than other districts.
Well, let's stay with the special needs.
All right.
Let's stay with those special needs. Because it seems to me that there is some evidence, there's some test scores that show quite a difference in their need and their abilities. Is it your position that the special needs are adequately funded so that they meet the constitutional mandate?
Yes, it's my position that the school funding system is constitutional.
With regard to special needs?
With regard to special needs and every other aspect.
What is the constitutional mandate?
The constitutional mandate textually is that the legislature, by law, shall establish a system of district schools which shall be as nearly uniform as practical. And such schools shall be free to all children in the district between the ages of 4 and 20.
Our job as a court, in part, is to interpret the Wisconsin Constitution. How should we interpret that clause?
I think what the court in Busey said is exactly the way to interpret a constitutional provision. You look to the text. You look to the constitutional debates, and you look to the laws that were enacted immediately following. But I would add one other that wasn't, it was...
I'm sorry, I don't mean procedurally. I mean, and I asked the question incorrectly, what should be the standard? What should be our interpretation of schools shall be as nearly uniform as practicable? What should be our standard for that interpretation?
I think that standard should be, as the Court of Appeals summarized KUPOR plurality, it should be one of deference, high deference to the legislature, taking into account...
Well, see, there I get into the how. The KUPOR court said how we interpret it is let the legislature interpret it. I'm saying, let the courts do the work of the courts, which is interpreting the Constitution. So... what should be our interpretation? What should be the Wisconsin Supreme Court's interpretation of that Wisconsin constitutional provision?
Can I add to that?
Sure.
Justice Bradley's getting at it, just saying it a different way, maybe, so that I understand it. From Busey, Busey or whatever, to Cooper to whatever, the courts have, but we have unanimously held them. That there is a fundamental right to equal opportunity for education. Isn't that correct?
I don't think that's the correct, exactly what has been
held.
Well,
what is it exactly?
Well, that's a difficult question since KUPOR was a plurality decision. Well, but I believe it said an equal opportunity to a basic education.
Equal opportunity to basic education?
Yes.
That's what you think KUPOR said.
Yes, okay. I believe that's what KUPOR said.
So I guess what Justice Bradley is asking, and what I'm asking, what does that mean?
Does that mean reading, writing, and arithmetic?
This I would answer it by saying that's not a... that term is not a constitution, is not a textual term. It's a term that this court devised. This court has held what it meant was that it would define the character of instruction and that it was for the legislature to determine to what degree that character of instruction could be achieved uniformly to extent practical.
My question. We're on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Our job, our job description, lots of things we do. But one of the things we do is we interpret the Wisconsin Constitution. Now, you may interpret it, the legislature may interpret it, local municipalities may interpret it, but let me sit up here straight and fall and say, hey, that's part of my job. That's why I'm here.
All right.
What should be our interpretation of the phrase, schools which shall be as nearly uniform as practical?
I think you should interpret that in terms of the process and the allocation of institutional power between this court and the legislature. I think you should examine the history of that provision.
Not how, what?
I know, and the result is one of great deference to the legislature in making the determination as to how uniform.
Then it's your position that when the Constitution says as nearly uniform as practicable, it means that the legislature determines what is as nearly uniform as practicable and not the court.
No, this court has held that it would determine what the character of instruction was to be.
All right, and so what is the character of instruction?
This court hasn't defined that.
Ah, that's the question I've been asking each of the council. Because after all, it's not fair to the legislature, let alone the people of the state, for the court to say, well, it's equal opportunity to basic education or equal opportunity education, or the character of instruction is what the goal is. It seems to me
the legislature needs some more guidance than that, and we have to give it in terms of what the Constitution means. So that's what you could say, well, the Constitution means equal opportunity to basic education. Character of instruction means equal effort. Therefore, the tax rate has to be the same. Or you can say that it means you look at the adequacy of the educational standards and look at what is actually happening, which is the issue of the categorical aids. So where do you come down? Mr. Meredith came down that this is a fusion of equity and adequacy, and referred to Wyoming and Kentucky, where the court in effect said reading, writing, arithmetic, arts, science, a basic knowledge that a person will have leaving school, K through 8, what is it, kindergarten, 8 through 12, that you have a basic opportunity to live in this society. And that's what we're going to look at. And the legislature has to fund that. And how they fund it is up to them. I mean, that's a legislative mandate.
Well, I have to say, Your Honor, first of all, I'm not the plaintiff. You know, I think the plaintiffs have some duty to come forward with what the standard is
they think
the state is violating.
You're defending the status quo. You're defending the present system. So you have to, therefore, have some standard yourself in order to defend it. You have to say, well, this is the standard, and this system meets that standard, right? So what is your standard?
My standard is one that commits to the people of this state through their legislature and through their school boards and through their direct vote matters involving their children's education. That is the principal standard. It's an allocation of power standard.
That's a constitutional standard.
That's the constitutional standard that I believe is correctly derived from the multiple provisions relating to the education, as well as the legislature's plenary power.
So you're saying we don't have a role?
I think this court's right. I hate to.
It's all right.
Hate to cut back your work.
We can go home.
No,
home.
I think.
That's right. Way too much.
We've got enough work. We don't feel that you're hurting our feelings.
Well, then I won't. Okay? I won't, Your Honor. I think for 152 years, that provision of the Constitution, as far as I know, has never even been held to strike down a statute of the legislature. For 152 years, this court has not taken it upon itself to second guess those complex policy and educational issues that go into the amount of funding, how it's distributed. For 152 years, we've had a system where money went from the state to all districts, and not simply the so-called poor districts. In fact, the system today is much, much more progressive than I believe it's ever been in the state's history. So that, I think it's just
strike down the negative aids legislation.
Well, not on the basis of Article 10, Section 3. It was on the basis of Article 8, Section 1.
Could I give you a hypothetical to try to illustrate the meaning of Article 10, Section 3? Let us suppose that all the school districts in the state are gathered in the room, and all the districts on this side have 4-year-old kindergarten. All the districts on that side do not. Now, it seems to me that these districts are not exactly the same. Do we have a duty to say that these school districts may not have 4-year-old kindergarten, or do we have a duty to say that all districts must have 4-year-old kindergarten?
I actually think that particular example, there is a case on point, Zweifel, which was 76 Wisconsin 2nd, which held that because one group of districts have 4-year-old kindergarten, it was exactly that, someone who wanted 4-year-old kindergarten for his child. It held that that does not create a right for all 4-year-olds to have 4-year-old kindergarten. And that's despite a textual provision that says we'll have free schools for all kids 4 to 20. So, I mean, that's notwithstanding at least the 4-year-old. So no, I don't think that it should be this court's role to decide whether four-year-old kindergarten is appropriate for all the school districts or for some of the school districts. That the decision whether a four-year-old kindergarten involves a host of considerations. What is our capital structure? Do we have enough classrooms to house the four-year-olds when we've got all these other students that we have to educate? Are we going to put money to four-year-old kindergarten but at the expense of teaching calculus to some of our more advanced high school students? These are the kind of, any time you're dealing with educational policy, you have a complex set of trade-offs, which creates an inherently legislative type of an inherently legislative character. And I don't think it is at all odd that the founders of the Constitution said that inherently legislative kind of determination would rest with the people acting through their legislature.
Well, how far can they go? How far can the legislature go? Could they come up with a system, for instance, in which 25% of the school districts were unable to, let's say, finance a foreign language course?
Constitutionally?
Yeah. How far can they go?
That's difficult. This court has said, at least the plurality in Cukor, and I think the majority in Busey said, if the legislature says you're not going to have public education, or that some group of kids aren't going to be allowed to have public education, yes, then we're going to step in. And, of course, that's consistent with the history of this.
But don't you think that if, in fact, the legislature devised a system in which 50% of the districts were unable to offer were unable to offer a foreign language program, or were unable to offer a computer science program, that, in fact, somebody ought to step in?
All right, Your Honor, and this court has said it would determine what the character of instruction would be, and it would be for the legislature to determine how much would be practicable. This court hasn't done that. The legislature has done it, and it has established specific standards by which school districts are to provide education. They are to provide foreign language, and they are to provide English, and they are to provide various courses. They're supposed to meet certain safety standards and so on.
Which, according to the affidavits, are not being enforced anymore because so many districts can't meet them.
There's a specific enforcement mechanism in the statute, which is, I think, 121.21.
But is it being used?
If it's not, then that's a problem with the enforcement of the statute. It's not the problem with the school funding program. I mean, why do we look to this, to strike down this very aggregative, I mean, it's a complex system, but it's nevertheless a very aggregative system for distributing $4 billion of state money. We look to strike that down because someone isn't enforcing the foreign language provision as to one middle school?
Counsel, could the state legislature do away with all of its funding and say all local?
I think for much of the state's history, that pretty much was the case.
That's right. So that would be your position then, that they could get rid of, assuming no federal laws, etc. They could get rid of categorical aid, and they could get rid of any state aid and say all property tax.
Right. I think although you have to, no, there's a school fund that is other than the school fund and the federal.
That's constitutional,
right.
But that's not very much money.
No, it isn't much money. It isn't much money.
So you say that the constitutional language, as nearly uniform as practical, really reads as nearly uniform as the legislature directs.
As the legislature determines to be practical. Right. The legislature is still...
And that's not reviewable.
Well, this court has said it will determine the character of instruction, but it is for the legislature to determine what is practical.
What are we determining on character of instruction? I don't understand it. If the language is to be read as nearly uniform as the legislature determines is practicable and not to be reviewed by this court, what is the court doing when it talks about character of instruction?
I wouldn't say that's the clearest part of this court's jurisprudence. I mean, it's not an
easy... Everybody comes up here, I have to tell you, every case we hear, it's not that either the legislature is not clear or we're not clear. So,
it happens.
So, again, I don't take offense, and I don't think anyone here takes offense But then you really says it's meaningless, isn't it? That's your position then. Apparent of instruction is
meaningless. I'm not saying it's meaningless. I'm saying that it commits to the legislature that establishment of district schools as existed in 1848. If we feel there should be more constraints on what the legislature should do, after 152 years where it has never been held to, any law has ever been held to violate that provision, including the period when really property tax was the main basis of school spending, then I think that what needs to be done is for this Constitution to be amended, not to... The impulse here, the courts have it, I guess, is to, if there's a problem, they should correct it. But I think the issue, the main issue in this case, is less about the school, or as much about the school funding system, as the nature of constitutional adjudication, where we're asked to grapple with very complex economic and social and educational issues in the guise of constitutional interpretation based on language that's sort of removed from the context of everything else, which was never even debated in the convention, and which in 152 years has never been held to have been violated.
Well, maybe it hasn't been held to be violated because your definition is whatever legislature says it is the way it is. I mean, that's what you're... If you are advocating as nearly uniform as practicable means, as nearly uniform as determined by the legislature, then by that definition, it can never be deemed to be violated, because by that definition, you are asserting whatever they say is consistent with the Constitution, and ergo no violation.
It probably is what I'm saying. But what is so? It is not crazy to get to the legislative branch.
I'm not saying it's circular. I didn't mean that was crazy. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think it's circular. I mean, it's not circular. It says the legislature is the one to principally determine educational policy at the state level. It is certainly the one. And then, of course, remember this case here isn't about a challenge to whether a school district is meeting the mandate of foreign language in a middle school. No one's challenging that there's something unconstitutional, that particular law is unconstitutional, or that's not being enforced unconstitutional. Rather, this is a challenge to the system of school finance, the system of distributing $4 billion in state aid. Given that is also very inherently legislative process, the distribution of state monies. In fact, the framers did not intend this court to serve as the determiners of educational policy in the state.
Maybe I have it wrong, but I just think it's our job to interpret the Wisconsin Constitution. And I know that I have an amicus brief here from state legislators who say, let us do our job, the legislators say. We'll give you the formulas. We'll decide how it's done. But courts give us a standard. I have a Court of Appeals opinion in this case that says that the Cooper Court did not establish definite standards. I have a Circuit Court decision in this case that says, Appendix 144, the problem is that the courts have not offered clear guidance as to what that right entails and how it is to be achieved. And I want to say, we'll do our job.
But I think what I'm saying is entirely consistent with what you're saying. I'm saying your job is to interpret the Constitution consistent with its text, its history, and its early interpretation legislation, as well as the 152 years of negative precedent. And I think when you do that job, you will conclude that what was intended by the framers was a system by which the legislature would be the one to grapple with these issues, not the court. And I'm asked these examples about, well, what if they shut down the whole system, or what if we don't provide education to this group? The fact is, in 150 years, that has never happened. We've committed to the people of the state, not to the adjudicated process, but the people of the state through the democratic process, the issues of how they're going to educate their children, and for the most part, they've done a pretty good job. There's plainly places where improvements, can be achieved. The legislature has made many improvements. I mean, there's this discussion that the legislature has done nothing for disadvantaged children. In addition to the categorical aids, which continue to exist, You know, we have the Choice Program in Milwaukee. We have a SAGE program, which is a targeted reduction of class size in the early elementary grades, which is being expanded through the most recent budget bill from about 30 schools to about 400 elementary schools. So in addition, the school districts, which have disadvantaged children, have a also get the largest amount of the federal aid. So we have a system. You know, it's funny how much data has come into this case since the record closed. And, you know, again, I didn't choose to bring the lawsuit before the ink was dry on the law. You know, maybe I think it might have behooved someone to wait until we had a little more data, but that wasn't the choice. I'm sorry, you're right.
I'd sort of like to address that point. The system changes every single year. What is it that you measure the standard against? If we were 25 years ago, there wouldn't have been Hmong students probably in the Wausau School District. And in fact, as I understand it, that particular group of people tends to move around within the state. Just a few years ago, computers. How do you expect the legislature to take into account all these changing conditions?
Well, I think that is the legislative task, Your Honor. Much more so than the judicial task. And it's much easier under the simple rule of majority vote than it is under a system of constitutional adjudication. The society changes, but those of us whose children are in school, we say to our legislators, we want you to accommodate those changes. We want you to recognize the fact that we, you know, kids now are should be computer literate. In fact, there have been expansions of that as well within the state aid program. So this is a...
Justice Bradley asked for some guidance on how to interpret Article 10, Section 3. Give us some guidance. What does district schools mean?
District schools essentially means the system of school districts that existed in 1848. The intent of the framers, as I read the decisions of this court, and as well as the constitutional history, was to preserve a system of district schools. At the time, transportation was much more difficult. And if you lived 2 or 3 miles, notwithstanding what everybody's grandfather said, if you lived 2 or 3 miles away from a school, it was a disadvantage. Towns were divided into districts, towns being a township or 36 square miles. So districts were schools that were provided for the local inhabitants on a smaller than town basis.
Smaller than town?
Yeah, smaller than town basis. There were districts, there at one time, I mean, this was in one of the historical documents we've looked at.
Well, would it be fair to say now that district schools means every school? It doesn't mean school district, does it?
Well, I believe it says a system of district schools.
It says for the establishment of district schools.
Establishment of district schools, all right.
I mean, but if you're talking about little towns, little one-room schools, that's what they were referring to, there could be...
And there were also larger school districts. There were larger schools and larger school districts. But there were, again, as I was trying to think, I've looked at a variety of historical documents. I think at one time there were something like 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 school districts in the state. 7,000 in the 1920s with about 6,500 operating as one-room rural schools. So, in fact, that was... The interpretation of Article 10, Section 3 has been that the framers wanted the legislature to continue the system of free district schools that existed at the time of the adoption of the Constitution.
But now, if you take that premise against some sort of equal educational opportunity concept, if the court were able to define that, would that mean that every single school building has to provide the same equal educational concept, or is it school districts or clusters of schools, or what is it?
Well, it's not something that I agree. It's difficult for me to buy the premise, so it's hard for me to explain the conclusion. that the legislature intended, had a specific intent regarding the funding of schools, which is quite different from the one we have today. The legislature, as far as I expected, to be able to establish, or the framers expected the legislature to be able to establish the curriculum, the required curriculum in the school districts. And it did that. The legislature did that in 1848. It continues to do that. I mean, it has been a legislative function. This court, again, historically, this court has said it would determine what the constitutionally required core curriculum would be, but then it never has done it.
Counsel, I think it's undisputed in this record that there are literally thousands of school kids, young kids, who come to school incapable of learning.
That sounds, incapable is perhaps a little too strong, but yeah, there definitely are kids who are much more disadvantaged than others.
Does the state have any constitutional obligation towards them?
No, the state has this constitutional obligation. It has a system by which the people in the legislature are to try to address those issues.
So if the legislature ignores them, there's nothing we can do.
I don't see a constitutional basis for this court to try to, but I don't know what you mean by ignore them. If you mean that the legislature, if there's no education for these kids, then that violates the basic, that does violate the basic text and interpretation of 10.
But if the legislature simply says, provide a basic education, which is essentially reading, writing, and arithmetic, and maybe some computer skills, thereby implicitly ignoring them, you see no constitutional impairment.
I guess I don't. The Constitution does not tell us how to deal with disadvantaged children.
Counsel, do you have... I'm going to write a short opinion. The opinion is going to say this. Children in this state, all children, special needs, disadvantaged, all children in this state, have a fundamental right to an education. Period. That fundamental right means that the distribution of financial resources must be done on an equitable basis that promotes equal educational opportunities. Period. End of opinion. Do you have any objection to that?
It's too imprecise, Your Honor. I think if we're talking about providing guidance to the legislature.
Let me cite from Rose versus Council for Better Education. Let me start the opinion with the same first sentence. There's a fundamental right. And then define that as each child with at least the seven following. One, sufficient oral and written communication skills to enable students to function in a complex and rapidly changing civilization. Two, sufficient knowledge of economic, social, and political systems to enable the student to make informed choices. Three, sufficient understanding of governmental processes to enable the student to understand the issues that affect his or her community, state, and nation. Four, sufficient self-knowledge and knowledge of his or her mental and physical wellness. Five, sufficient grounding in the arts to enable each student to appreciate his or her cultural and historical heritage. Six, sufficient training or preparation for advanced training in either academic or vocational fields so as to enable each child to choose and pursue life work intelligently. And seven, sufficient level of academic or vocational skills to enable public school students to compete favorably with their counterparts in surrounding states, in academics, or in the job market. Does that give enough detail?
It doesn't tell me how's the case come out. Did we win or did we lose?
I'm going to concur. I will concur. That's Justice Bradley's short opinion. I'm going to concur and say, I agree with everything Justice Bradley stated, but I'm holding for the state because the court has no authority or business in interfering with the legislative determination. The legislature determines without judicial review what is nearly uniform as practicable under the Article 10, Section 3. How does that suit you?
Your Honor, I think to be more faithful to precedent of this court, if what Justice Bradley said is the standard, then the court should affirm, not because of the deference, because this court has said it will define the character of instruction, and if that's how it wants to define it, it can define it. But because that's a challenge to Section 121.21, it's not a challenge to the school finance system.
Well, okay, I'm not going to join her. I'm just going to write. I'm going to ask this of the other counsel here to write a decision. One of us is going to draw this case, and we have to have a sense of at least what the parties think should be the decision. So I'm not going to join her. I'm just going to write that I'm going to dismiss this case because this is not a justiciable issue, because the Constitution provides the legislature shall provide what constitutes as nearly uniform as practicable. Therefore, this court should not be reviewing any financing matters set forth by the legislature. I mean, I think that's your position.
Well, it's not quite, but it's similar.
Tell me, okay, you can amend. You can concur and amend my position.
No, I don't think this
And I'll court. Adopt it.
Well, that's, I think that's very generous of you, Your Honor.
I know that you feel that way.
I didn't know it worked this way.
I'm trying to have you fix it up so that what comes out of this court is something that's intelligible and understandable by the legislature. So
I would say, I started talking about this census case, and I really think that that is very similar. We have a textual commitment to the legislature.
Absolutely.
It does not mean that this court cannot review funding decisions. Obviously, the court can review funding decisions. For example, if we had a funding decision that said money will only go to Methodists, I mean, that would violate constitutional provisions.
Come on, we're not going to say that.
Right.
Close.
No, I'm saying if there are legislation, you can.
But that we're not. We're not
you can review them, but you have to review them.
Let's stay with 10-3, counsel.
Right. You have to review in terms of the substantive standards. The substantive standard of 10-3 was that the legislature was charged with continuing the system of district schools that existed in 1848. This court's precedent has held that once those have been established, it has discharged its duties. However, that this court would determine the character of instruction, and then you can decide what you want to do, what define the character of instruction, but that a system of school finance is so disconnected to the character of instruction that on this record, there's been no proof or no reason to believe that there's been any constitutional violation.
Well, but you should then we can review. Once we set the standard, we can review the financing. Is that your position?
I think judicial review is certainly permitted. I mean, we have provisions in the Constitution regarding financing. We have a variety of provisions, including the legislature is the one that's gets to do it. I mean, the legislature is the one that establishes appropriations to begin with. It's not just school financing, but we also have so much is to come from the school fund, and so much is to be matched by the local districts. But school funding that doesn't violate those provisions violates no textual provision or historically interpreted provision of the Constitution.
That's true here. We haven't violated into Sections 4 or 5 of Article 10. What I'm trying to do is go along with, you seem to think we should do the character of education. So Bradley has done that, okay? Then you seem to think that we can review the funding. You're not willing to say the judge can't review the funding. So now then, but you don't think the record is good enough here for us to review the funding and say that it doesn't fit the character that we've set forth. So should we send it back and get more facts?
No, there's a specific statute that establishes the legislatively defined character of instruction. This court can look to that and say, well, I wouldn't do it in this case because it hasn't been developed. I mean, I wouldn't be doing that, but that's what I would say the court is trying to do if it's determining whether the legislature has met with the character of instruction. If since 1848 and the development of all the technology is no longer adequate to teach the three R's, sometimes called the four R's, I can't remember what the fourth one is. If that's the case, that's fine. And look to the statute by which the legislature so defined what school districts are to teach. But to take that and say, well, let's strike down the school funding formula on these very vague assertions of unconstitutionality, because the equity and adequacy aren't adequately merged, I have no idea what that means or what the positive evidence that proves it. It has no constitutional basis.
So if the parties can bring another lawsuit and they say, look, here's what the legislature says is the character of education. This is what the state says. And then show that some, all, many school children are not getting that because it's not adequately funded or for any other reason, this court can then say, you're right, and order the legislature to add more money or do something? Is that your position?
The provisions you're talking about are statutory.
Yes.
Well, the legislature can't violate its own statutes. So if the legislature's provisions are inconsistent with the statutes it's enacted, it's considered an implied repeal. If the court says, here's the constitutional standard, you have to teach English, then the question would be, is English being taught? Or rather, first, has the legislature established that as a standard? Okay, you look through the 121.21, it does. Is the mechanism provided by that adequate to ensure that English is being taught?
Suppose the answer is no. Just suppose.
Then that's a deficiency in 121.21.
But not a constitutional deficiency.
No, it would be a constitutional deficiency in 121.21. It would be a constitutional deficiency in the legislative definition, including its enforcement of the standard.
Okay, we've kept you over.
I'll be glad
45 minutes goes by very quickly.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Hours, counsel, hours. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Hazy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Article 10, Section 3 is a limitation. The legislature has plenary power. Article 10, Section 3 was not necessary if it is to be interpreted the way the state wants to interpret it. The framers had something in mind when they wrote the education article. It was, as I indicated in my opening remarks, that education was a state function, that education was to be provided without privilege to everyone. The court has developed the concept of an equal educational opportunity, finding that in the uniformity clause, and finding it as a fundamental right. Now, character of instruction or equal educational opportunity, and in my judgment, to some extent, those are overlapping concepts, if not entirely overlapping concepts, depends on funding. The Rose case says that. The Brigham case says that from Vermont. The other cases that we cite say that. It really goes without saying that educational opportunity is a function of the school finance system. What the proof in this case has shown is that educational opportunity in Wisconsin is a function of district wealth. The wealthier districts are able to provide more. The DPI has acknowledged it. The state superintendent has admitted it on deposition. The deputy state superintendent has admitted it on deposition. The affidavits that have been provided by the people who know best, not only superintendents, but also parents and students and teachers. All of those people have said, look, in our districts, we don't have the same opportunities as exist in other districts. The statistical and comparative data that we have provided show that the system is imbalanced, that there is not equal access to resources. Pages 28 and 30 of our brief, our principal brief, take pairs of districts, and it could be, and it, these are just examples, but take pairs of districts. First of all, districts that are spending approximately the same, and it shows that in those that there's a disparity of tax rate as between those districts. Then there's a set of districts where the spending is approximately the same and the tax rate is disparate. How can that be uniform? Mayor Norquist's brief points out that MPS does not have the same capacity to spend as many of the surrounding districts surrounding Milwaukee. How can that be uniform? I would just say in conclusion that Article 10, Section 3 is a provision which has meaning. It is not simply a delegation to the legislature to do what it will in education. The legislature didn't need such a delegation.
In summary, in five sentences or thereabouts, what does the opinion say?
I could be quite comfortable with Justice Bradley's first opinion or even the one that relies on Rose.
And then what do you say? Send it back for more facts? And what kind of facts? Or you say the financing is invalid?
I think you can find that the financing is invalid per se because the proof we put in shows that there is not equal access to resources and that adversely impacts education. And you have the basis, you have the means to fashion a standard where the legislature can go back and rework the system and make it constitutional.
Thank you, Mr. Hassan. Mr. Merida.
I'd like to spend my brief time responding to two members of the court and an argument made by the state. First, I would like to respond to Justice Prosser's concern about the horrors that will the natural difficulty in ever having a standard of complete uniformity. And no one has ever argued for that. To take your example of the four-year-old going to kindergarten, I don't think our Constitution requires a school to establish a gifted and talented program so a four-year-old can enter school early. It may require the establishment of remedial programs for a four-year-old so they can enter kindergarten or the first grade with some understanding of the English language. And so I think what this case is not about is precise uniformity. What it's about, and I believe what the affidavits demonstrate, is that some kids are being denied the right to compete in this world as economic marketplaces and as citizens. And I think every child deserves a chance to succeed, and that's what I think we're talking about. I would like to respond to Justice Abramson's remarks about can we develop a standard. I, too, would be perfectly satisfied with the standard enunciated by Justice Bradley, but I think I can give it some concrete definition. I think constitutional system must have three things dealing with Wisconsin's current system. First, it must distribute sufficient resources so as to give all districts the funds necessary to allow students to become educated persons, regardless of the district's property wealth or its educational needs. Second, to the extent to which the state seeks to control expenditures, it must do so on the basis of factors found in the reality of school finance and actual student needs, and not based on mere political calculations. I think the problem with the current revenue controls is that it produces vicious cycles of decline and virtuous circles of improvement, and the winners are largely determined by what your student demographics are, and I think that cannot be constitutional. And finally, I think to the extent the state chooses to impose academic standards upon children, it must provide sufficient resources so that all children in all districts can have a realistic chance to meet those standards. Those would be my three concrete things that need to be done with the Wisconsin system. Now, I'd like to respond to the argument that this court has not adjudicated a case for 150 years, therefore, no right must
Therefore, there must not be a right. You know, it took almost 100 years after the passage of the 14th Amendment before the U.S. Supreme Court and Brown v. Board of Education realized that there was a right for people, children of color, to go to school with Caucasian children. And in that case, they were told for many of the same reasons the state is arguing now, that they shouldn't mess with race relations. It's too difficult a concept. It should be left to the states. But the court faced up to its constitutional challenge, and our country has been forever better for that. In many ways, this case will affect high-needs kids as dramatically as Brown v. Board of Education affected students of color. And we ask the court to give all children a chance and to, in fact, ensure that the constitutional mandate is fulfilled.
If you apply your three standards, you would say that this is unconstitutional on its face?
Well, I think there are two aspects of the formula that the state has never controverted. You've never heard in any of the arguments the state to say that all children cost the same to educate and that the current formula takes that into account. You've never heard the state say that you can track district costs on a dollar-for-dollar basis, and therefore revenue controls are rational. I think on those two bases, this court could find on this record that those two aspects of the system are unconstitutional. I think, however, on other aspects, the court may be well advised to simply overturn the summary judgment and allow for a full trial to develop a full record. Now, especially since the state has imposed a large competency-based testing, we now have a wealth of data from which to operate.
Thank you, Mr. Meredith. I want to, on behalf of the court, thank all of the counsel in their argument and counsel and amicus in their briefs. This is, everything has been very well written, and we appreciate it, and we appreciate not only the marathon paper, but the marathon arguments. With that, we're in recess.